This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Hello, and welcome to Dissecting Dragons. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, seasons may change, stars, farmers, and wild weather calendars.
Well, Jules, it's been a hot minute.
It's been a long time. Not so much an apology, but an acknowledgement that we, for the first time in like 7 years, we had to take a bit of a sabbatical just because life kind of overwhelmed both of us in terms of stuff we had to do. And then we could have each done with like a double to carry on.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. That being said, though, I was definitely missing our weekly discussions.
Yeah, big time.
So we're going to come swinging back in, and we're so happy to have you guys back with us, listening to us again.
You know who else is probably happy about this? It's Alan, because he's had to listen to all my rambly bullshit because I haven't had anywhere else to put it.
Please, for the love of God, go back to your podcast.
It's not over, is it? Tell me it's not over. Of course it's not over.
Okay, so why this episode? Well, I've been thinking, basically. As the blossoms have begun to bloom, as the seasons have begun to change, I've actually been doing a lot of work and things which consider the seasons and the importance of the seasons. And so I suddenly went, we've not actually ever talked about this. And I think you might go, okay, so, but why are seasons so important? Yeah, they're a thing that happen, but, you know, the seasons have always hugely impacted humanity. They dictate how we spend our days, what we wear, what we eat, where we go, and how a season plays out can be a matter of life and death. You know, even in the age of modern conveniences where you can have, tomatoes grown in sort of other countries and brought over and things like that, you know, the seasons continue to play a powerful and essential role in our lives.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that every living thing from, you know, plants and trees to, you know, lizards to mammals to everything else to obviously humans does kind of have to pay attention to. And humans are usually more sentient, more aware of it, and that's been the case since we lived in caves, essentially. We would not have survived as a species if we had not learned to preserve and to hunt and, you know, to dry meat and dry fruit and roots and things like that in order to be able to feed ourselves through winter. And the bit that's where the starvation really is the early springtime before anything's ripe, before anything's growing.
Yeah. So it's obviously no surprise that the seasons play a major role in the folk tales and myths across the world, in every culture. They're personified as gods, they're used as symbols and metaphors, and they're added to provide context, suggestions, and meaning in a lot of stories as well. In fact, in some cases, they can even be used as a kind of setting, which almost creates a unifying element to stories. I mean, think about, we've talked about how in fairy tales and stuff like that, you don't get really the sense of location often. But you can get a season, so it can be, it was summer, and that is almost a setting up onto itself, you know?
Yeah, and if you look at, you know, fairy tales like Snow Queen and East of the Sun, West of the Moon, the heroine at some point has to pass through all four seasons to get to winter.
Yeah,
in order to actually achieve her end game.
Yeah. So in fiction today, seasons can be used in the same way, sometimes very subtly and sometimes with very obvious intention. So today we're going to look at some of the ways that this has been done and how you can use the seasons in your own writing.
Okay.
So I think we should probably start off with the obvious question of, okay, you keep saying this word, we sort of know what it means, but what actually is a season?
Yeah, so the Merriam-Webster definition of a season is a period of the year characterised by or associated with a particular activity or phenomenon. I almost said pheromone then, which would have made no sense.
Also. Associated with a particular pheromone.
I mean,
it's a whole other science of...
there are obviously several ways that the year can be divided, with the categories often sharing a lot of overlap. And, you know, depending on where you are culturally, there's obviously a lot of difference there too.
Yeah.
The ways people might divide a year include agriculturally, astronomically, meteorologically, and anthropologically. So let's have a quick look at all of these.
Yeah. So we're going to start with agriculture. And the word season comes from the French saison via the Latin... Sationem, which actually it means the act of sowing, as in not sowing with a needle, sowing seeds. When humans moved from hunter-gathering societies to agriculture, their lives would have largely been organized around the sowing season and the growing season and the harvest season. These seasons were not fixed, and they were dependent on the crop, the terrain, and the weather, among many other things.
This is obviously reflected in myths and folklore and customs around the world. I mean, we've obviously already talked about the whole idea of, you know, even... It's probably the basis for very early religion, actually, the seasons.
Yes.
Yeah. Just in terms of the hungry season, the season of famine, the season of going to sleep kind of thing. Our very early folk and fairy tales probably came from those sources, as, you know, recent studies have suggested.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, a few examples. We obviously have the Hades and Persephone myth, which breaks the year into two seasons, the growing season and the dying season, with obviously Demeter refusing to grow things and allowing crops to wither while Persephone is away. And so there is not only this association between this idea of things growing during part of the year and then things no longer growing, but obviously this actual association with death, literal death.
Yeah, definitely. Then there's the Hopi story of the Blue Corn Maiden, which describes how the beautiful Blue Corn Maiden divides her time between the spirit of winter and the people of the Pueblos. I think that's how you said that. Spending 6 months with winter before returning to the people to bring them corn, creating spring. That's a really interesting example. There are many others, similar but different examples amongst Native American tribes.
Yeah. And so obviously I have to talk about this because this is something I absolutely adore, which is obviously the Celtic calendar. Now, there are 8 major festivals in the Celtic calendar, but 4 of them revolve around agriculture. So you have Imbolc, which is in February, which was related to lambing season and essentially marked the end of winter. Beltane, which is in May, which marked the beginning of summer and was when farmers moved their livestock into the summer pastures, because you now had all this beautiful green area, so they would go out. Sometimes that would also involve putting them up in the mountains, etc. You have Lunasa in August, which marked the beginning of the harvest season, and then you had Samhain in November, which marked the end of the harvest season and the beginning of the new year.
Yeah, obviously depending on how far back you're going as well, they recognised mm-hmm. 5 seasons. So they had winter and midwinter. Midwinter was its own separate season. I understand from a friend and fellow writer who lives in Australia that in Australia they commonly recognise 6 seasons.
Yeah.
So they kind of have like a petty spring and a petty autumn kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
And she sort of laughingly said, yeah, we don't try and fit all these amazing things that are happening into just 4 seasons. That's not enough space.
But yeah.
She kind of has a point.
Yeah, she does. Now, while we... Blah, 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 blah. Good. My language skills are improving every day. While we tend to use the Gregorian calendar now to divide the year, the agricultural seasons continue to play a really significant role. I mean, for example, if you're in England, obviously you will know that the school term and the year is dictated by agriculture, with the school year beginning in September, when logically it really should begin in January, but it doesn't.
So January's halfway through the school year. Obviously, yep. This is because it leaves the 3 month period of the most heavy harvest time free, because the point was all hands were needed to bring in the harvest. So if you ever see things where you have the lord of the manor sitting around while everyone else is bringing the harvest in, that's not what happened. Unless you were literally aristocracy, you were out in the fields bringing the harvest in with all your servants and probably the governess who was living in the house and all the people, everyone else. Everyone was used, because even those who weren't strong enough to wield scythes and whatever were going after those who were reaping and picking up the stray bits of corn and what have you, so nothing was wasted.
Because the window for harvest is actually quite slim.
Yeah.
And obviously, again, depending on what you're harvesting, because there's several harvests, that's the thing, and again, it will depend on the crop. Which is why the agricultural calendar is so interesting, because obviously when we come to England, the main sort of big crop would have been wheat, but not just wheat. We have wheat, and then we kind of have a later one for apples and stuff like that.
You have your cereal crops, wheat, barley, rye as well to a certain extent, although that was always a bit iffy. Corn, we don't mean corn on the cob, which is what you generally mean in America. Our corn was literally a type of cereal plant. And as you say, you get more into the autumn and you're harvesting fruits and things. And then as you get into late autumn, well, that's pickling, preserving, and brewing and baking season.
Yeah.
Some of which you might do over the winter, but the bulk of it you had to do then, because they didn't have refrigerators and freezers and things like that.
Absolutely. Okay, so let's move on to the astronomy side of things, so breaking it up astronomically. Now, astronomy has provided a reliable and regular way for people to measure the passage of time. In fact, the first written concept of the four season appears to come from Varro's Rerum Rusticarum, my Latin, which was around 37 BCE. Now, actually, this was an instructional manuscript on agriculture and animal husbandry, but Varro defined his four seasons using celestial movements, attributing exact dates based on the passage of constellations. So rather than saying, around this time you would do this, he actually said, this is when. He had actual dates, and he was using the stars to do it.
Yeah, I obviously don't want to go off on too much of a tangent, but this is still something that is used in terms of growing plants and things.
Yeah.
If you happen to get an almanac for the year, you're generally given pretty good advice on when to plant certain things and when to harvest certain things. You'll find it in things like Culpeper's Complete Herbal, which is still a really useful text if you like herbalism. And, you know, by here herbalism I mean natural medicine and natural soap and beauty products. I don't necessarily mean experimenting with drugs.
Yeah.
Although you could, I guess. I don't recommend it, but you could. But you'll find in there that every single plant that he talks about, as well as having it as medicinal uses and things, it has its ruling planet and when the best time to harvest it is. And there is some truth to all these things. I don't think enough time has been put into sort of scientifically studying them to back them up, but they are there.
Yeah. Now, of course, Varro was far from the first person to use astronomy to mark the year. I mean, going back to the Neolithic period, there's evidence of people marking the movement of the sun and building monuments with intention based on the position of the sun during certain parts of the year. Now, the solar year could initially be divided into two very clear halves, with the solstices marking the longest day and the longest night in turn. And the time between these solar events were then divided to create two equinoxes, which sit precisely between the solstices in the solar calendar. Now, these solar events were used to divide the year into quarters and are now used to technically mark the beginning of each season. And this is funny because technically, if we do this, and this is what is officially done, winter begins on the 21st of December, spring around the 20th of March, summer the 21st of June, and autumn around the 22nd of September. And the thing is, even though those are the official things, I think that really we still tend to feel we tend to lean more towards the agricultural one. You know what
I mean? Yeah, I would agree with that. For certain things, I can see why people would go with the astrological calendar, but ultimately you have to be very practical and say, well, this is growing now, it's growing early this year, it's growing late this year.
Yeah, absolutely.
Again, we have to work with the plant's time frame.
Yeah, and even if you yourself are not engaging in agriculture, you know, for me, I don't tend to think of summer starting in June. I tend to think of it really already being in, you know, in sort of May. And I tend to think of spring already coming when you start to see those first blossoms, which can be in February and stuff like that. So it's this, it's an odd thing. And
yeah, I mean, I have to say, for me, May is kind of late spring. June is really the beginning of summer for me. But, you know, some calendars, the Irish calendar, it still technically counts September as being part of summer.
Yeah, I would still think of September as part of summer.
And it certainly can be. If you get an Indian summer, September can be blazing.
Yeah, it really
like
can
it was
be.
Last year.
Yeah. Which kind of actually leads us on to the next subject, which is the meteorological calendar.
Yes. Now, the meteorological calendar uses measurements such as temperature to identify when spring, summer, autumn, and winter begin and end. So, in theory, that would make more logical sense for today's mindset. However, the weather also offers many different kinds of season, which are used to divide the year. For example, rather than spring, summer, etc., many countries on or close to the equator divide the year based on a wet season and a dry season, which makes a lot more sense for those areas.
Yeah.
These dictate things like agriculture, but also prompt the migrations, habits, and accommodation of nomadic people, or they did. As well,
they still do. We still have nomadic people and stuff like
absolutely,
that.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
As well as the arrival and behaviours of certain animals and insects. So again, you know, the swifts don't really care about a calendar. They care about, well, this feels really warm. Maybe we'll head to England, you know?
Yeah. Now, the wet and dry seasons also have many subcategories. And while some countries actually may share a particular season, they don't always occur at the same time of the year. So here are a few examples of these. So the monsoon season in Indonesia is between October and April, but it's between May and October in Cambodia. And you could also call it the mosquito season, because with the water providing plenty of places for mosquitoes to lay eggs, you tend to see a large, you know, an uprising of mosquitoes during that time. So instead of monsoon season, you could call it mosquito season.
Well, you know, July, midge season in Scotland.
Yeah, exactly.
Actually, it's late July, early August.
Yeah.
But yeah, they have a definite midge season, which you wouldn't think, because everyone says, Scotland, it's cold, it's damp. And it's like, except at that point in the summer where it's warm and everything hatches.
Where it's warm and damp.
yeah.
You then have the rainy season, which occurs between April and October in Ghana, but is December to March in Botswana. Now, with flooding increasing the territory for crocodiles, it's not uncommon for more crocodile attacks to occur during the rainy season than during the dry season. So again, you could call it crocodile season. and then finally, January and March is cyclone season in Australia and New Zealand, while hurricane season is between July and October in the Caribbean and in Hawaii. Now, what's interesting is many birds can sense changes in air pressure before or during a hurricane or a cyclone, and they will go silent and hide. So I kind of have this sort of this idea of what if you called it the silent season? Because it's just suddenly the birds all stop singing because there's so many hurricanes.
Yeah, I have to say, I mean, the whole, it's something that even still some humans can still pick up on, those subtle changes of pressure.
Yeah.
So the same sort of subtle pressure drops you get before minor earthquakes or major earthquakes, I found as a child that I could pick them up. I think I still can, actually. And you have this weird unsettled feeling, almost like a buzz under your skin. And then you notice that, you know, the animals are hiding themselves away, particularly cats and dogs and things like that. So so we do still share that with the so-called lower mammals, but you know, we've kind of trained ourselves not to pay attention to these things because very few of us live close to the land anymore.
Yeah, absolutely. So finally, let's talk about the anthropological calendar. So the last category of seasons we're going to talk about are the man-made seasons. So these are seasons which we have created or defined, which fall outside of the agricultural, meteorological, and astrological calendar, but may be influenced by them in some ways. Now, man-made seasons have the most scope and will often speak of the hobbies, values, ideas, and lives of those who are aware of them or who are using them.
Yes, sorry, I've just looked further down. We'll get to that in a moment. I'm most curious about that one. So, some examples. Obviously, you've got, like, winter sports, so ski season, if you want to call it that.
Yeah.
A period of time when the snow conditions are optimal for skiing, with the skiing and tourist industry in certain areas revolving around, from ski instructors to restaurants to chairlifts. So, I mean, in certain respects, you could apply that to any kind of hospitality type season.
Yeah.
There's definitely a hospitality season around seaside resorts in the UK, for example.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You then, if we continue with kind of sporting stuff like that, you have fishing season. The periods in the year when you're allowed to fish, essentially. And depending what you're fishing, the times will vary, and there is usually a close season where fishing is not permitted, which is usually during the mating season for the fish, because you want to let them restock themselves and then grow a little bit before you start catching them again.
Yeah, same again with obviously hunting season, and
yeah. You know,
pheasant season over here in the UK runs from October to January.
Yeah, rabbit season.
Theoretically, you can shoot rabbits all year round.
Yeah, I know.
Rabbit season.
Okay, so then we have fashion seasons. Now, with different temperatures calling for different clothing across the year, it's not a surprise that this is reflected in fashion, with major fashion shows usually split into spring, summer collections and autumn and winter collections.
I feel like this has got a really strong historic link with things like the London season and the Bath season.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You know, which is, again, it's like, well, we're going to go out for the season. It's like, it's almost like humans had their own mating season at that time.
It's like, it's this 3 months of the year, we'll spend it in London and we'll have a season out in society meeting.
Yeah.
And essentially, you're right, that's exactly what it was for people wealthy enough to have one.
Yeah, absolutely. We then have the season of giving. Now, this obviously covers a variety of festivals, usually towards the end of the year, which involves gift giving or charitable acts. And this is really funny because, again, lots of different religions and stuff like that, and yet we will have this idea of, yes, we'll have a season of giving, but we'll just have a time where you really focus on giving gifts to other people, having parties, doing charitable acts and stuff like that. It's kind of strange, isn't it?
Yes, maybe in some ways, but also I think this is another one that's got really long roots, and not necessarily from like the religious aspect of it, but
yeah,
just in the sense of you get a lot, or you're given a lot, particularly if you're living close to the land. So we're going way, way, way back.
Yeah.
All through the year, it kind of makes sense for there to be a season where you're giving something in return. For some reason, humans do seem to work on a very reciprocal idea. Weirdly, so do crows and magpies.
Yeah, absolutely. I think also that there's a practical element to it, which is, let's lean into charitable acts and stuff like that and give during a time when, if people are destitute or in bad positions, this is going to be the worst time of the year for them to survive. So it makes sense for charity to increase during times when it's colder, where food is more scarce, etc.
Yeah.
Okay, we then have the cleaning season. Now, this is usually in spring in the UK and America. Obviously, you have spring cleaning and stuff like that. But, you know, I think in a lot of places across Asia, there's actually this idea that cleaning season is kind of happens at the end of the year during winter, before the new year comes in. So this is a season when essentially you clean away the dregs of the year or the previous year in preparation for the new one. Again, kind of interesting.
This is so baked in as well. This is really incredibly baked in, and it's not limited to humans. If you've ever seen a badger set in the beginning of spring when they're properly awake, rather than in that semi-dormant state. I mean, badgers don't really hibernate, but they can't always go out very much in the winter, so they'll sort of be in this sort of stupor for a lot of it. They literally turn their sets inside out. They drag all the old bedding out, and they make a hell of a mess, and they drag new bedding in. And it very much looks like somebody's spring cleaning, because that's essentially what it is. And they're not the only animals that do that.
Yeah. You just made me realise I'm a badger. Just throughout winter, just in a haze, and then, oh, right, time to change the bedding.
Freshen everything up. Those cobwebs have got
to
go.
Yep.
I mean, in fairness, Alan and I are currently cleaning out the garage, so...
Okay, so I learned an interesting one recently, which is stick season. And this is conned by a guy named Noah Cohen for his song and album of the same name. And it covers the period after Halloween, but before the first snow. I think he's in Canada. And basically reflects the depression and the anxiety the singer was feeling. And I do think that, you know, a lot of people, particularly who get SAD or sad, you know, with the weather changes and stuff like that, you know, after the excitement of sort of Halloween and things like that, the November month is actually quite dreary for a lot of people as well. And so it was kind of, I know that it, and it's slowly been spreading, this idea of stick season, when all the leaves have now fallen, the branches are bare, but it's not actually, we don't have the wonders of winter yet in full. We just kind of have this cold, wet season where everything kind of just seems to be dragging on.
Yeah. Yeah, I can see that. I mean, like, it's like January being the most depressing month as well, isn't it?
Yeah. I would almost say that.
And then the hangover.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly it. January kind of is stick season, I think, as well. Two stick seasons in a year. Okay, so the next is festival season, which is a period where the most major music festivals occur, usually from late spring to the beginning of autumn. And this is a real, I mean, this is a real thing. And it even if you listen to other forms of music, like, okay, so just fun little story time. Obviously, I'm getting married this year, and my uncle is really, really big into folk music. He does a lot of the folk festivals. In fact, he's pretty much well known among all of the circles around there. And when we were planning our wedding, my fiance and I, 2 years ago, we sort of, the first person we consulted with was him, because we said, look, it'll be in the middle of festival season, because it'll be in the summer, so we need to find a date where we're not going to be clashing with you going to all of your festivals. Now, he would have still come regardless, but we didn't want to kind of interrupt it. So it is a real thing, and a lot of people do actually kind of really move around it, because it's no surprise that during the summer months you see this uprising in music, but also the arts, theatre. You obviously used to have the roaming players, etc. So it's kind of an interesting phenomenon, but it's also unsurprising. This idea that, yeah, you start with, you know, that like the May Day plays and stuff like that. It was all happening.
Yeah. I'm just thinking there's probably a wedding season as well. In fact, there is.
Because yeah, there definitely
very
is.
Very popular to get married on Whitsun.
So yeah.
Just sort of after Easter, coming up to May Day.
Yeah.
Which, you know, all folklore tradition tells you to not get married in May. It's
yeah.
It's supposed to be really bad luck, but then...
Yeah, you know. Don't get married in May, but you can get pregnant in May.
Yeah.
So the next is writing season. This is something which I feel is developing a little bit, and I think it kind of revolves around events like NaNoWriMo, where certain months have started to be associated with writing or drafting for some creatives, as well as writing and book events creating a writing or even literary seasons. Now, this is one of those things where most of us are writing throughout the year, but I think that there is this kind of this big upsurgence in people talking about it, and, you know, again, people saying, right, this is the time I'm going to sit down and write a new draft, etc. Unless, of course, you're Jules, in which case you're drafting in your sleep.
You think you're joking?
No, I don't. I know you. And finally, we have spooky season. Obviously, this is a term we use for our October specials. But the spooky season... Sorry, go on.
I was just going to say, it's not just Madeline and me talking about spooky season. Obviously, we have our spooky season where we're like, it's October, it's the spooky season, and yes, it might roll over into November and possibly as far as December, it depends how we feel, etc. It's not just us. If you're someone who watches any or follows any booktubers or follows any book bloggers or anything like that, they have a spooky season as well, and it's very similar to ours in that respect. They also do things like Summerween, where they kind of we're like, we miss Halloween, we're going to have a Halloween in the middle of summer kind of thing.
Yeah, I feel like Gravity Falls really Summerween really popularised that. Now, the spooky season often coincides with festivals like Samhain, Halloween, the Day of the Dead, etc. But it also extends, as Jules said, into the winter, and is a period where we just particularly enjoy sharing spooky stories. Again, which is just funny, in that we just suddenly went, you know, I understand why, but we just all went, you know what? We like spooky stories during this time of the year. We actually like spooky stories during the whole time of the year, but the types of spooky stories change a tiny bit.
Exactly.
Okay, so let's talk about the seasons as symbols. Because it's no surprise that with the agricultural and anthropological importance placed on the seasons, that from the common literal characteristics such as blossoms in spring and snow in winter, people have ascribed symbolic meaning to the seasons. As with most things, there is often a duality to the symbolism, with lighter and heavier themes. Sometimes you might even say, hold on a second, these are in total contrast to one another. But often, actually, there is this kind of this cycle element to it. So let's have a little look, shall we?
Yeah, definitely. Obviously, spring. You know, most religions, most folklore, most practices and things would say new beginnings and new chances, so that's an obvious one.
Yeah, absolutely. And with, I think, the new beginnings and the new chances, new opportunities, there's a kind of a theme of hope. This hopefulness of life springing up after the dead of winter.
Yeah, we survived.
Yeah. Hooray! And because of that, I think there's, you know, themes of potential and possibility.
Yeah. New love, puppy love. It's really interesting you've put puppy love there, because that is kind of a, if you've read any coming of age story, particularly a one with a slight historical bent that has a romance as part of its main plot, that's nearly always an unformed version of, you know, the final love kind of thing, and it's almost always set in spring.
Yeah, absolutely. Where it is this, it's almost like the crush phase of the sort of very innocent first steps, almost a level of naivety to it as well. Which is also funny, because then you have the contrast of spring also being a season of fertility and sexuality. So yeah, you have the sort peculiar. Of... Yeah, you have the puppy love, and then you have the rabbits having a lot of sex. I'll leave it at that. Obviously, we have this idea of the new beginnings and new chances, but I think there's also this theme, obviously, of regeneration and resurrection. And again, it's unsurprising that during the spring months, we also have, you know, religious stories and things like that, which have those kinds of themes and those ideas. So, like Easter, for example, regeneration, resurrection, rebirth, etc.
Yeah, and obviously that was largely... Let's say the timing was chosen very carefully to coincide with stories that were already extant with those themes at their centre.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which were also set in spring.
Largely. Yes. Yeah. As part of this, there's also this idea of dormant ideas taking the first step into fruition. So, you know, not necessarily that you're having new ideas in spring, but perhaps some of the ideas that you had in winter are now starting to take their first steps. Like a seed which has been lying dormant is now suddenly starting to grow. You know, you planted something before and now actually it's starting to kind of move into the light. And again, unsurprisingly, this is a season of children, babies and youth.
Yeah, particularly young girls. It's very much in line with the sort of French idea of the jeune fille en fleur, you know, young girls all flowers. Women, are very young women on the cusp of adult womanhood.
Yeah.
Depending on how far back you go, there's a distinctly creepy side to that. But there is also this celebration of innocence on the edge of wisdom kind of thing as well.
Yeah. And I mean, I think in terms of sort of the elements and things like that, spring has this big association with lightness and air.
Yeah.
Okay, so we then move into summer, which is which is, I think, very much associated with the idea of joy and fun, but also hard work. And I think there's this kind of this, I don't necessarily like the phrase, but it's the work hard, play hard idea.
Yeah, there's definitely something to that. I mean, in some ways, that's an association, particularly for us in the UK, because the summer holidays are the longest holidays. And depending on what sort of school you go to, you might have a very long period of time off over the summer.
Yeah. Exactly. And I think it's, you know, an element as well in that this was a time where, you know, you would have a lot of social events and things happening. So, you know, you have socialization, family gatherings, etc., all happening at the same time that you are, and the arts are obviously being kind of sort of really used and stuff like that, you know. And at the same time, there's obviously a lot of work to be done. In preparing for the harvest, animal husbandry, etc. So it was a busy time, but because you had this very long day, you kind of had more time to do things in.
Yeah.
So I think there's also then this kind of element of romance and sexuality which comes into it, which is the more developed version of what you had in Spring. So in Spring it was very much puppy love, and now this is the more mature version. This is the more sort of, you've kind of graduated from YA to NA, if that makes sense.
Yeah, this is the more adult, long-lasting, in theory, relationship.
Yeah. Absolutely. And more, I think there's more element of sensuousness to it, too.
Yeah.
Life and vitality, obviously, are sort of big themes in Summer, because now everything not only is growing, you know, it's really starting to come into fruition and things like that. So we're really starting to see it's the green months. And so there is also this element of growth and the prime of life. You know, this is the prime time where everything is possible. And in that way, I think it is very much the season of young adults, young parents. So, you know, when I talk about young adults, I'm not talking about teenagers. I'm talking about, you know, being in your 20s and in your 30s, etc. And like I said before, the never-ending day, the opportunity, it's almost like the day that never ends. So you don't have to stop, you can just keep going with everything.
Yeah, again, this is kind of reflected in obviously folk tales and things, but it kind of reflected in the way that, if you want to, I could be talking out of my arse here because it's been quite a while since I was in my 20s, but how someone in their 20s would go about enjoying themselves at this time of year. I mean, there's more scope for being out and being out late than being comfortable. Again, we're talking about here in the UK, we don't tend to have tropical temperatures, although that's changing. And the fact that, you know, we have a relatively big drinking culture here in the UK, and it's something that most people grow out of, as in you just go through a phase of it. You go out a lot, you socialise, you maybe do a couple of dumb things, and then you stop, you grow up. And it is a normal part of development, shall we say. Mm. Although there's less of it now that everything is documented online. But yeah, that side of things, the sort of let's do something really crazy, let's do something a bit mad. Let's just take off for the day and take a picnic and walk as far into the hills as we can and see what we can find. That kind of slightly reckless side of things.
But the thing is, I know what you're talking about, but there is something funny about it. It's like, let's be reckless. Let's go have a picnic. Yeah. The sheer recklessness of having a picnic. But I do know exactly what you mean,
Well, I mean, I've known some lads who decided, let's go out on a boat. Where are you going in the boat? Don't know, we're just going to row and see where we get.
Yeah.
And they ended up in the Isle of Wight, thankfully, but they could have gone very badly wrong.
Yeah, that could have really gone terribly badly.
And it's, you know, people do get caught out, people have accidents and things, but by and large, it's almost like the gods forgive youth. They give it a lot of latitude.
Yeah. Yeah, honestly. Which moves us into autumn. And autumn, I think, is probably one of the most interesting for me, because it's one of the big themes is beauty of the growing darkness, I think. And so there is this, you know, this kind of this idea of we've had these long summer days and now things are darkening and we're actually appreciating that. And there's this beauty which is surrounding all of it, which I'll talk a little bit more about in a second. But
it's like if you've got youth and inexperience in spring and then youth and cocksureness in summer, by the time you get to autumn, it's kind of like maturity and the knowledge that death is around the corner at some point.
Yeah, but you're not at death's door yet, you know. You're actually in quite a comfortable position, but you've kind of made your peace with death.
Yeah,
absolutely. Now obviously we have this harvest, the collecting the fruits of your labor, so it can be, you know, a harvest in terms of a literal harvest, but it can also be the harvesting of ideas, the harvesting of all the efforts and savings or etc. that you've put into the year, all coming in now to roost. I think there's also this idea of slowing down and introspection. It's a reflective period. After the summer, which was very much all sort of... A summer feels very much like action, and autumn tends to feel more like thought, or slowing down towards thought, as you get into winter.
Yeah.
I think there's also... Autumn is associated with intimacy.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, again, I'm trying to, I guess, go back to the text, as it were. But if you think of love stories that start in autumn rather than in summer or spring, they've got a very definite different flavour. And they tend to be coming from the perspective of intimacy before sex rather than the other way around.
Yeah, absolutely. It's kind of the idea of being indoors rather than outdoors, this idea of coziness, closeness, physicality, etc. And like we said, that maturity that comes with it. And what is particularly interesting for me, which I've already touched on, is this idea of the vivacity of life on the cusp of death. And this is, I think, reflected in the colours of autumn, in that, you know, we're about to get into the season of death, as it were, and suddenly there's all these vibrant colours all around us, the reds, the golds, the oranges. We suddenly start obviously using a lot of spices and things like that, so we have this vivacity of flavour. We tend to have, because obviously it's getting colder, there's also this heavier foods and things like that. It's kind of almost like a feast in preparation for the colder months, and a feast for all of the senses, which I think also ties in with the idea of accumulated wealth throughout the year, and now you're almost at retirement, essentially, and you can enjoy that wealth.
Yeah, definitely.
Naturally, of course, there's also death in the other world, which begins to be, you know, come to fruition in autumn with a lot of the spooky season stuff coming into it. But in contrast, we have death in the other world, but we also have hearth and home.
Yeah, I mean, an interesting point here is obviously going back to the Celtic calendar. Samhain was actually the beginning of the Celtic New Year, so they kind of started with winter and moved their way through, which makes sense if you think of like the body of myth and story.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's one reason why it ties in with death in the other world and hearth and home, strangely enough.
Yeah. And I think there is... autumn is the season of fire, I feel. In that... You have that kind of that heat, the fire start to be lit, etc. And we have a lot of fire festival-esque things. I mean, we tend to have fire associated with a lot of things. So we have fire obviously coming in during May, and then we have it during autumn. And if again we look at the Celtic calendar, it makes sense that Beltane you would have these bonfires, which people would be jumping over and things like that. You have Calan Mai as well and stuff like that, and that's on an equinox. And then during this other equinox, this one isn't the equinox. The equinox is earlier, but it is around the autumn period. You have, again, these fire festivals coming in, the fire at that point, and then again, this idea of protection, etc. And I think as part of that, as we said, it's more mature, so it's a season of adults and adulthood.
Yeah, it's a season of maturity.
Yeah. Okay, finally, winter.
And that's it. It's winter.
It's just winter. It's the end. Finish now.
Winter is unsurprisingly a time of hibernation, of things being static or frozen.
Yeah. Is the sort of this time standing still, almost everything kind of not necessarily ending in some cases, but literally there is a point, I think, in winter, which is why I kind of understand the midwinter and winter, where everything just stops, I think.
Yeah.
And so then you know, following that, you have death and decay. I think the problem with decay is we tend to think of very gross things when we think of decay, but, you know, and so perhaps that's not a very pleasant association, but it is associated with winter.
It's really necessary. I mean, whenever anyone complains about wasps and says they don't serve any purpose, it's like, well, actually they serve an essential purpose. They're part of the decay cycle. And if things were just left lying around and not decaying, then we'd soon be hip deep in them. So it's like decay itself is actually really essential. It's not always convenient and it's not always pleasant, but it's necessary. I mean, it's the same. Okay, let's take this to the nth degree. So if somebody died and their body didn't decay and it was just there, it's like, okay, well, you could bury that one. But what about every other person who died and didn't decay after that?
Yeah.
It's a real issue. And you've got to think of the Earth as a closed system in the sense of it has a certain amount of atoms, of elements, etc. If you're continually taking things out to build things that then don't decay and return that matter to the closed system, you're soon going to run out of stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. It's one of these perfect... It's one of the essential points of the cycle. It's not necessarily the most pleasant, but it's essential. What's very interesting is that, obviously, winter is associated with death and decay, but it's also associated with beauty and perfection, which I think ties in with this idea of time standing still. And again, it's why I can kind of understand why you would want to split the winter into sort of two seasons, because snow has this heavy association with beauty and perfection. Everything's covered, everything's still, everything's perfect for a brief period of time. So I do think it's kind of interesting. At the same time, winter is obviously very much leaning then into that silence and introspection. But again, in contrast to that, you have the silence and introspection, but you also have the noise and the celebration and social aspect of winter too. Winter has this weird dichotomy.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, as you say, the silence, the introspection, the withdrawing, etc., that is all very much there. It is also, weirdly, a season of light, because light, if you like, is more prized at this time of year than any other.
Yeah, and again, it's that contrast, darkness and light, I think. It's a season which is very much occupied with the idea of the family unit, the clan, the sort of small groups coming together. And it's also, again, just as with spring, it has an association with children, weirdly enough.
Yeah. How many children are conceived in the winter? Probably quite a few.
And quite a few of them, yeah.
Certain people have are more likely to produce or conceive during the winter. I think everyone's heard about the Cern giant, right? And how certain couples will sneak out and have sex on his phallus in order to be fertile.
Yeah.
there may actually be some scientific evidence as to why this works, and it has to do with getting your testes really cold.
Wow, okay.
Because sperm tend to function slightly better in slightly colder conditions, so you get better quality sperm, which is more fertile. So there you go.
There you go. You heard it here first, guys.
No, someone else has definitely come up with this before.
Yeah.
I'm just repeating things I've read. But again, this is something that ties into the whole winter thing. There's a reason a lot of animals have their fertile season in the winter. Mm. And some of it is the fact that you're not giving birth until food starts to appear. Which is definitely useful.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's obviously associated with children and with seeds, this idea that you have these seeds and they are going to lie dormant. There's a period of sleeping where you don't see fruition happening, you don't see anything happening, it's below the ground, in the womb, etc. But over time, that will begin to change.
Yes.
Okay, so we've just gone through all of that. You might at this point be asking, okay, but why does it matter? And what does it actually mean for your writing? Well, I personally think that a lot of people overlook the importance of the seasons and their various forms in our lives, which means they miss an incredible opportunity for world building, character development, atmosphere, and symbolism. So if you are writing something, you know, you might want to ask yourself, how do seasons actually work in your world? Does your protagonist follow an agricultural, astrological, or personal calendar? And depending whether they do, you know, does that reflect also their background, their upbringing, etc.? How does the season reflect the mood of the story? Can the changing of the seasons be symbolic of your character's journey? You know, all of these things are worth considering. And you don't need to be explicit in adding these things. They can just be in the background. But I think they do add an extra level of context and atmosphere. Yeah.
I would also add that if you're not aware of the seasons taking place around your story, you are at risk of continuity error. I've certainly seen it in books where there's one in particular where it was a case of, it was one of those quite torrid and intense romances, historically set in a historical setting, everything was great. But then you had the characters who finally kind of got together and they were having sex outside. And then, like, two scenes on from that, they were decorating a Christmas tree. And I'm like, you were having sex outside in December?
Helping with the fertility jewels. In Yorkshire.
It's like, come on. So it's that sort of thing. And you can't have them picking apples in one scene, and then 5 minutes later, they're out gathering bluebells. And again, this is something that I've seen happen. People can be remarkably oblivious to when things actually sprout and flower and when you can get them. So unless you're making a point that everything's happening at once and this is a really weird world, have a care kind of thing.
Yeah, consider it carefully, guys.
It's like, why is it raining? Is it raining just to be convenient to you, or is it very likely it would be raining?
Yeah. And again, also think about the fact that if you are writing there's a certain kind of area that your story is taking place in, are they going to have the same seasons as the rest of us? You know, where on the equator is your story set in your world? If you're going to go with that kind of that very intense world building, because they might not have defined seasons in the same way. It might be a wet season and a dry season. Astrologically, it might also change things depending where you are. You might find that there is less variation in terms of how long summer days are versus how long winter days are. There are certain parts of the world, for example, where you really don't actually get that much variation in how long the days are at all. So,
and then there are some where you literally get a month of darkness.
Yeah, exactly. So be conscious of it. So let's look at a few examples to round us off of books which we feel have actually used the seasons in interesting ways, or have actually really leaned into sort of using the seasons. I'm going to start us off with the Song of Ice and Fire, or the Game of Thrones books, because obviously George R. R. Martin has just gone, I'm not going to explain how this works.
Yeah, but weirdly, that's one where I like it and it annoys me at the same time.
Yeah, where they have these very, very long, year-long kind of seasons. And I actually think, really, it's not actually that they have these seasons at all. It's just that they go through phases where they might have more intense years than others. So they might have a mini ice ages every now and again, and that's what they call winter. They do actually have these like petty winters, but they don't consider it that way.
Yeah, well, you get little bits of snow, but compared to the great winter that can last 8 years or more, then it's nothing.
That's what my theory is. But obviously what's happening with the Song of Ice and Fire is that you have these year-long kind of seasons, and it's also very symbolic. You know, the winter is coming kind of element was literally about the apocalypse. But also it allowed you to have things like Sweet Summer Child and stuff like that, leaning into naivety, everything being easy for you, etc.
Yeah, because all the Stark children are tech worth, apart from maybe Rob and John, all the others are actually summer children, aren't they? They were born in sort of 8 to 9 years of summer.
Yeah, exactly. So they've never had to experience necessarily the hardships. And of course, this is also reflected in the fact of what was literally happening in the books, which was Rob and John were born during times of war, and all the rest of the children were born during times of relative peace.
Yeah.
So there's a lot going on there with the seasons and not just quotable memes.
Yeah, I think it also kind of demonstrates the idea that you can lose sight of the fact that just because things are okay now, that they might not be okay in the future, and that you do actually need to be storing stuff away for the future.
Yeah, absolutely. So I obviously, I'm going to mention this very briefly, and that I used the seasons and stuff like that also within the Hamartia cycle. And one of the reasons I'm bringing it up is that with the Hamartia cycle, they obviously base everything in Hamartia on the astrological calendar. They use the stars for everything. It's obviously for their magic, but also for their seasons and stuff like that, and their timing, and everything is bent on that. And that's happening in Hamartia, and then if you go over to Bithynia and things like that, they are very much reliant on an agricultural calendar instead. So they have different festivals and things along those lines. They see seasons in a different way, and they're much less rigid. And part of why I did this was there was this idea of also exploring the difference between the agricultural and the astronomical calendar, which is that one is very academic, the other is very practical. So one is very much about calculating things according to mathematics, according to the movement of the stars, etc., whilst the other one is very much about, well, we're doing this as and when we need to do it. And it, for me, brings up this idea of this class, that using, dividing the year in that way brings up discussions about classism, education, practicality versus patterns, etc., and the separation between what is good in a textbook and what is practical in the everyday.
Yeah.
So that was my small way of using seasons in the Hamartia cycle. I'm also going to mention the Snow Maiden, or Snegurochka, which we have done an episode on in the past. So you can check out our Fairy Tales in Focus, where we talked about the Snow Maiden, which again, very much is obviously leaning into the seasons. It's a story about seasons, and the seasons being meaning or signifying the growth and change of a young girl, particularly in the Andrew Lang translation version, which is the one that I think most people are going to be familiar with. You know, this idea that she burns away or she disappears when she tries to jump the flames of Beltane, which, as we all, well, they weren't Beltane, but you know what I mean, the flames during the sort of the May Day celebrations. And as we've said, with this association of that kind of leading to maturity, sexuality, first love, etc., moving away from childhood, which was very much what was happening before. And what's very interesting is obviously in some versions of the story, she returns and she lives with her father, Father Frost, in the state of perpetual winter. So she's always perfect, she's always a child, etc.
Yeah.
Which is also kind of a bit creepy in the verse, like, she died as a child, so she's perpetually a child, death, time stopping, etc., all coming in. It's, I mean, unnerving, actually.
Never loved that story.
I kind of like it for its potential.
Yes, I know exactly what you mean.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's almost like a comfort tale, isn't it, for anyone who's lost a child?
Yeah. Yeah, I think so.
Basically, yeah, anything that contains a seasonal fairy court of some kind. So there are too many to mention, really.
Yeah.
And some of them do it better than others, in my opinion.
Yes.
Probably in everyone's opinion, in fairness, depending on where you stand. Obviously, SJ Maas did tap into this with a Court of Thorns and Roses series, but I kind of feel that it was more of an aesthetic for her.
Yeah, which is the thing with her is that she has they obviously have the seasonal courts, and then they have the solar courts. And the thing that I didn't understand was the fact that in the solar courts you get all of the seasons, because they said, oh, you know, we couldn't just stop the solar system, you know. And I was like, but the seasons are also connected to the solar system. The way that, anyway, it doesn't matter. As you said, it is very much to do with an aesthetic kind of thing. But also, I think it does add an element of symbolism, particularly with, you know, this idea of new potential, first love, etc. In the first book.
Yeah. I will mention Melissa Marr's Wicked Lovely series, which is one of the best young adult fairy-centric series I've read. There are others. Mm-hmm. Holly Black's very good as well, but this is very seasonal. Mm-hmm. So the first book, I think there's like 6 or 7 books in the series, but Wicked Lovely is the first book, and the main character is a sighted human. So she knows fairies exist, and she tries to avoid them at all costs, because generally what fairies do if they realise you're sighted is that they will blind you.
Yeah.
And she's always been told you must avoid them. And then one of them realises she's sighted. Instead of blinding her, he starts this really heavy campaign to get her to lift this ancient artefact, because what he's looking for is he's the King of Summer, and he's looking for his Summer Queen. If you happen to be strong enough to be the Summer Queen, that's it, you'll be transformed and you will become the Queen of Summer.
Yeah.
If you get it wrong, the staff or whatever will kill you. With one exception, there was someone he persuaded to try this deadly task called Donia. And Donia tried it, and the staff kind of looked through her and said, you're strong enough, but you're not Summer, and made her the Queen of Winter, and she's extremely bitter about this whole thing.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of push-pull stuff going on, and the main character desperately trying to remain human because the fairies kind of creep her out for good reason. They're not great. They are very indifferent from a human perspective. So it's very, very tied into this idea of a summer court and a winter court, and then as you go on further through the series, you do get other courts as well. They are not merely an aesthetic. They are very specifically tied to certain skills, abilities, powers, and you know, occurrences that would be linked to the seasons.
Yeah, absolutely. Obviously the Dresden Files, they did the same thing as well. In fact, there was obviously a whole book where there was this fight between the two courts, the winter and the summer court, which almost resulted in what would have essentially been an ice age. I also think it's worth mentioning Naomi Novik's Spinning Silver, because even though they weren't necessarily seasonal courts, the fairies in that, the Starik, were very much winter creatures, and obviously the fire creature, which had taken over the Tsar, was almost this creature of summer, and it was eating away the ice and the winter and things like that, which meant that the Starik were then trying to elongate the winter by stealing gold, which in some way basically trapped the sunlight. which I thought was such an interesting idea.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I keep coming back to that book and think, I really want to reread it. I need to find time.
It is so good. It's probably one of my favourite fairy tale retellings. I have to mention A Christmas Carol as well. Because I think A Christmas Carol, you might not think about it, but one thing I like about A Christmas Carol is that you obviously have the three ghosts. And they actually, for me, represent all of the main components, particularly the dichotomy of components of winter, in that you have this child of the past, this shadow, the remembrance, the memory of what has been, innocence lost as well, and then you have this jolliness, family, unity, the time of not of plenty, but of sort of having gathered things and finding and creating light in the darkness. But again, that is tied in with this possibility of you now have these new seeds coming into fruition. And depending how you plant them, these new children will dictate the future. And then obviously the future also then being associated with death as well. So I feel like Dickens, like, he really just ticked all the boxes there.
Do you know the thing that really struck me? I reread A Christmas Carol basically once a year in December, and I reread it obviously again last year. Mm-hmm. And what really struck me was that all these years I've been reading it and I've been seeing it with snow on the ground. There is a light dusting of snow on one page. The rest of it is freezing fog and wet streets and icy cobbles. It's not actually snowing in London at all. But like every adaptation you see, they've got like snow and everything looks really Christmassy. And it's like, it's not like that. It's actually pretty miserable.
Yeah, it is. I think what's quite interesting is when you also look at how it's adapted. So if we look at The Muppets Christmas Carol, right?
Yeah.
When during the period where he's with the Ghost of Christmas Present, it's beautiful outside. There is that light dusting of snow, but it's sunny. Everyone's having a good time. But when it goes into the future, there's no snow. It's raining. It's cold. It's miserable.
Yeah. Yeah, they do play with it in that respect very, very well.
Yeah, they really do.
Brief mention of Shauna Maguire, because she is very, I won't say focused, she's very tied in with seasons. They're very symbolic to her. They come up in a lot of her writing. In fact, I think they come up pretty much in everything she's written, and I've read almost everything she's written.
Yeah.
They're certainly a part of the October Day series, which is no surprise because October Day is urban fantasy that focuses almost exclusively on fairies.
Yeah.
And so you have your seasonal courts and, you know, being tied to certain powers and things, etc. Certain times of the year, the tithe, everything else like that. Her alchemy series, which... I've only read the first book of, but even though it's really focusing on maths and transdimensional realities, it's strangely seasonal at the same time. And then also things like her Velveteen Versus series, where Velveteen is a superhero who can animate teddy bears and dolls and things. And yet there's one book, the third book, is Velveteen Versus the Seasons, and Velveteen's kind of trapped in this sort of seasonal alternate reality where she has to basically do an east and sun, west of the moon to get through all these different seasons before she can get back to her own reality.
Huh.
So again, if you ever read any of her short fiction as well, she taps into seasons a lot as well.
Yeah.
I would also like to mention Robin Jarvis's The Deptford Mice, because while it is a background theme, it is really important. You start off in, you know, this is a book with mice as the main character. Main characters even, and the big villain ultimately is a huge marmalade cat that's been alive for about 500 years. Jupiter. Anyway, the first book, The Dark Portal, it starts on Audrey and Arthur's naming day, and a naming day is when you receive your mouse brass and you face the seasons in effect. The facing the seasons is part of the naming ceremony. It's an adulthood rite where essentially you have to go through the they set up these little rooms for the mice to go through one at a time, so that they can face the green mouse. The green mouse is the local teacher whoever dressed up in greenery and what have you in a costume, generally, except that's not how it comes across for Audrey. Don't want to spoilify it, but everything is a little bit too real for her, so when she accepts her mouse brass, there's something a bit off. But the whole idea is that they, as adult mice, learn that fear is going to be part of their lives. And that while we're in spring now and you'll go through an abundant summer, winter is going to be around the corner.
Yeah.
And the books follow the same pattern. So the Dark Portal is set in early spring. The Crystal Prison is set in summer, but it's quite chaotic in summer. It's all the bad things of summer, like drought and thirst and raised tempers and mobs. And then you get to the final reckoning, and I don't want to give spoilers because I really think people should read these books. I don't think they're sung about enough. But you get to the final reckoning, and it's winter, and the sort of winter where it's like the blood will freeze in your veins kind of cold, where there's no relief from it.
Yeah.
Really, really good kind of heroic fiction where the main characters are mice. Very tied to this idea of the seasons and the fact that during the winter the green mouse, their god, has very little power because he's essentially sleeping, so they're on their own.
Yeah, I can understand why that would not be great for a mouse.
Final plug, Tamora Pierce's Circle of Magic, which I've mentioned before. The reason I would mention this one is the fact that the first four books, certainly when the children are about 10 or 11 years old, every big disaster that they're facing in each of the four books is very much tied up with the seasons. So in the first book, everyone's got this sense of unease and whatever, and the reason is that somebody has come up with this fantastic magical device that traps earthquakes or repels earthquakes from their own city. The problem is, when you do something like that, it doesn't make the problem go away. It just means the pressure builds up in the Earth's mantle in a different place, and you get, a much, much bigger quake kind of thing. It's very tied up with the sort of seasonal sense of change and beginnings and stuff in sort of spring. Then you move on to the next book, where you get early summer, but it's really hot. It's too hot. Someone's monkeying around with the seasons, literally, this time, and it turns out that they're very much doing it, they're holding back storms and things so that pirates can sweep into the bay after all these earthquakes where the defences are down and plunder everything. So again, very much tied up with the seasons of the time. Again, you get much late summer and early autumn, and they're dealing with forest fires. So, I mean, they all sound like quite petty concerns, but it's all about the children learning to use their magic and learning to be adults and what have you. And the final one, you get the really wet part of autumn, which generally brings disease with it. And the final book is about this dreadful plague breaking out in the city.
Right.
Which has come through the watercourse system.
Ah.
So, I mean, it's really quite intricately plotted out for books that essentially kind of middle grade, the early ones are anyway. And then you get the Circle Opens, which is the second quartet, and again, it's very closely tied to sort of seasonal things that are happening.
That's really interesting.
I desperately want Madeline to read these books because I know she's going to completely fall in love with the characters, because it's kind of cozy, but certainly
after all that, you're going to tell me it's kind of cozy.
It is kind of cozy. It deals with some hard-hitting stuff, but it is essential found family. And also, I think Madeline's going to read it and go, oh God, that's where Cuthbert came from. Not because I've taken somebody from the page, but in the sense of the way that the characters relate to each other, that's kind of, you can see the seeds of a new character being born in someone else's mind, if that's not a really weird image.
Yeah, no, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. Okay, I love that. Okay, I'll definitely have to check that out then. So, that's it. We have reached the end of our episode. I feel like there was so much more we could have talked about, but I hopefully this has all made sense to everybody, and we'd be very interested to hear what you guys think, if there are any books, films, etc. that you think really do play with the seasons in an interesting way. What kind of seasons you have, for example. Are you in Australia and have to deal with swooping season? Please let us know. Or if you think we've missed something out, you know, get in contact with us. We love hearing from you guys. Now, before we go, it is time for our Dissecting Dragons recommendation of the week. And I have got one for you guys. So recently, I watched a series on Netflix called House of Ninjas. It is a Japanese series. It's a live action, and I believe it is based on a comic book series. It essentially it's set in modern day Japan and follows this idea that there is a shinobi family who are basically operated by a special branch of the government. And the story begins where, after one of the last missions, which was supposed to be their final mission, one of the children died. It's basically a family of seven, but the eldest son was killed during the mission. And since then, they've all gone into retirement. But unfortunately, the enemy that they thought they had defeated forever is not defeated, weirdly enough, and slowly but surely they've all got to be pulled back into the game, with the second eldest son in particular having a lot of difficulty with it because he feels responsible for his brother's death. It was very enjoyable, very well acted, some great humor, some fantastic fight scenes, and definitely worth watching, I think. So if you have a chance, do check it out.
Cool. That sounds like fun.
It is. It was fun. What was particularly good was that the music choices they made, the music choices were very interesting in that they had a lot of kind of like Beatles-esque stuff. So you've got these fights happening with this very sort of mellow music, which actually really added, I think, to the humour and stuff of it. So it was very interesting. And on that note, guys, we will say thank you very much for listening, and we will catch you guys next week.
Thanks and goodbye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note, no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.